Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're about to have another conversation with Danny McLean, who's a contributing writer for The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute, where she focuses on race and on reproductive justice, and joins us once again. And welcome, Danny. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier this week, we had a really intense conversation about what happened in Colorado between several people on the panel, one of whom was a very conservative thinker, and the other two African-American and been progressive thinkers. Mm-hmm. And it was really heated just around the whole question of where life begins, and we see that as kind of stopping murder, in other words, stopping abortions, but falling short of saying, but being very clear, I do not support the action of this person who did the killings in Colorado. But it's such a conflicted subject, and I just in this country, and I'm really curious your reflections on all of that, given your work around race, but also given your work around reproductive rights. And when that hit, I'd like to really hear what you went through.
Well, you know, I was devastated by the news, you know, to hear that there had been a 5-hour shooting rampage that left 9 people injured, 3 people dead, including a police officer. I mean, it was just devastating. Also, I mean, it's devastating on its own, but in the wake of hearing about the shooting into the crowd of Black Lives Matter protesters in Minneapolis and
right.
hearing, you know, the news out of Chicago, it just felt like such a devastating week. Also on the heels of, you know, hearing about these governors saying that the federal government, you know, should not be allowed to send Syrian refugees to resettle in their states. It just feels like such a bleak time. But when I heard the news out of Colorado, you know, I was very, you know, I really wanted to kind of wait and wait for details to roll in. But then when I heard that a law enforcement official said that after Robert Louis Deere was taken into custody, he said something about no more baby parts. And then, you know, on top of that, I heard Planned Parenthood Rocky Mountains official say that witnesses, those who survived the scene, you know, added that Deere had been motivated by opposition to safe and legal abortion. I just started thinking a lot about the rhetoric, you know, the connection between anti-abortion rhetoric and the possibility that someone who is not stable and someone who is very much on the fringes of society, which we now know that Deere was, you know, how possible it is that someone who's really on the fringes and unwell could latch onto rhetoric, anti-abortion rhetoric in this case, and do something incredibly violent. So I think that's, you know, basically where my thoughts have been since then, just really thinking so much about, you know, despite whatever claims certain anti-abortion, anti-choice groups want to make about, you know, how they don't have anything to do with Deere and how, you know, you can't put this on them. I think it's just a really important moment for us to reflect on the connection between violent rhetoric and you know, lies, efforts to mislead the public. And we could talk about the Planned Parenthood videos, heavily altered videos that were released back in July, the connection between those and what has happened recently. But yeah, just the connections between lies and violent rhetoric and the potential for something very terrible to happen.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I was listening to you, I mean, it's always difficult to kind of raise this issue because things get so convoluted and so complex. On our show was raised the question that of likening the anti-abortion movement to the anti-slavery movement because of Plessy versus Ferguson and before that and all the Supreme Court decisions about slavery and saying that was the law, but you had the right to break the law to stop that, and making these comparisons. And so it becomes everyone in the who's anti-abortion is not like this crazy right-wing person.
Yes. I would agree with that.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, there are people who have very just and powerful reasons. Some of the Catholic radicals I know who just believe in the sanctity of all life. I'm against capital punishment. I'm against what capitalism is doing. I'm also against abortion, but I'm not going to stop a woman from doing what she believes she should do. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? But there's also this connection between a very right-wing, very conservative movement going on and the anti-abortion movement. And there's this weird intersection for me between that and race.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I would say a couple of things. One is that, we heard leaders within the anti-choice movement making comments, of course, not approving of the shooting that happened in Colorado Springs, but saying things like, quote, "It's acceptable to violently kill a baby, so why isn't it acceptable to violently kill other people?" Which, is this kind of question that this was said by Judy Brown, who's the president of American Life League. She said that in a phone interview with MSNBC. I think I just find that so difficult to wrap my mind around. If you call yourself pro-life, which is what they tend to do, then you should be, as you just suggested, in favor of the sanctity of all life. And I think we're seeing fault lines within the anti-choice movement right now. It's really an opportunity to question, what do they mean by pro-life? Whose life are they, whose lives do they actually acknowledge and value? The point that you raise about the connection to race, I mean, what I've been thinking about is, again, going back to this issue of rhetoric. So when there's been this movement among some GOP presidential candidates, but it's been a kind of right-wing claim more broadly, that because of the Black Lives Matter movement, there has been this increase in what they call anti-police sentiment and anti-police rhetoric. And then they have been trying to, hang different violent attacks on police, which are not, we're not seeing an upswing in them, by the way, but the few unfortunate cases in which police officers are targeted. We've seen conservatives try to say that this is a result of the, rhetoric and the dangerous, environment that's been created by the Black Lives Matter movement. Okay, well, there are all kinds of holes in that argument, but right now is an opportunity for them to, if they truly believe that, to make a similar connection between, anti-choice rhetoric and this kind of the lies that have been told about Planned Parenthood harvesting and selling baby parts. The rhetoric that we saw in the congressional hearings that kicked off, this fall, saying, all the terrible things that Planned Parenthood does and all the reasons why it should be defunded or that its Medicaid reimbursement should be taken away. Why isn't there a similar line being drawn between the lies and the misconceptions and the rhetoric and what has happened in Colorado Springs? So I think you make an interesting point about race. The way that I've connected this current this recent shooting to issues of race and in this country have been more along the lines of kind of, when we're willing to say that dangerous words create dangerous actions and when we're not.
Right. And there's a line that's really difficult to parse out sometimes. I mean, what happened in Colorado clearly in many ways was fueled as what happened in Charleston by the kind of rhetoric that filled these people's brains about the danger that lurks around them and what they have to do to stop it. And when people say you shouldn't say they're crazy because they're white, don't say white people are crazy when they do it. Don't say when black folks kill that they're crazy, they're monsters and thugs. And all that's true. But these people were, I mean, nobody does that kind of killing unless something's really wrong, unless they're part of a planned conspiracy to really kill people, which some people have done in abortion clinics. It's been a conspiracy to kill people, not crazy people, a conspiracy.
That's right.
Right. So, and I think it's kind of dangerous to let ourselves get sucked into that. And how do we begin to talk about this in a way that protects women's rights and the right of women to choose, not be afraid to talk about the right to have an abortion if that's what you want?
Right.
I think we're afraid to talk about that.
I think we are, and you know, I think you make an important point about the fact that this is not all, that the accounts of violence, violent attacks on clinics are real, and they're not all the result of, you know, people who are mentally unstable or unwell. There's a woman online. She's a she. Her name is Michelle Kinsey Bruns, and she tweets under the name Clinic Escort. She had a really powerful, she did something really powerful after the news broke out of Colorado Springs, and she started this hashtag called Is 100 Enough? And she tweeted 100 violent attacks on clinics that have occurred over the past 40 years. This includes bombings, arsons, you know, murders, attempted murders since 1977, just to show that, you know, for the people who want to act as if, oh, you know, these are, there's no kind of epidemic of violence against clinics, that this is wrong. And, you know, I mean, just some of the things that she was finding to tweet about. Apparently in May of 1985, a man used a World War II amphibious vehicle painted with a Cobra logo to ram into Sacramento's Planned Parenthood. I mean, the level of kind of planning and just strange, you know, war, right? I mean, this is someone who used a war vehicle to try to take down a Planned Parenthood. So I think you're right. Many of these are coordinated attacks that cannot at all be blamed on people being, you know, crazy, quote unquote, but are evidence of a deep desire to keep women, people more broadly, away from reproductive health care and health care more broadly. I mean, I think you know, I've gone to Planned Parenthood to have my health care needs met. So many people have, not just women. They provide so many services other than abortion, whether it be, you know, whether it be access to contraception, testing for sexually transmitted infection. And for these people to be so intent on shutting down our ability to access critical health services is just absolutely wrong. I don't see how anyone can defend it.
I mean, and she does. As you were speaking, one of the things I did is I looked her up. I'd never heard of her before you mentioned her. But she does. She lists all these things from you look at what has happened from the 70s on.
Right.
You know, when she starts with, in 1976, Joseph Stockett commits the first reported abortion clinic arson in Eugene, Oregon, not his last. About another clinic where Hope Clinic owner and wife kidnapped and held 8 days with a ransom demanding that Reagan end abortion. Someone throws gasoline on a receptionist and sets the building on fire.
Yes.
14 picketers led by ex-KKK leader John Burt. I mean, there are these connections here. We don't get the depth of the violence that's taking place here. So I wonder what it is that what a response should be. As someone who writes about politics, as someone who writes about the political life of this country, what are you hearing about what the responses should be?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I wish I saw something that I found particularly inspiring, to be honest with you. I mean, I think for so many people, you know, so right after the news came out of Colorado Springs, you saw, you know, the Democratic presidential candidates tweeting that, you know, Hillary Clinton said, "Today and every day I stand with Planned Parenthood," and, you know, Bernie Sanders made a statement that this is he actually used the phrase unintended consequences, but these are the unintended consequences of such dangerous rhetoric. I think people feel that it's a moment where if you are in support of expanding and maintaining access to reproductive health services, you double down. You know, you donate to an abortion fund. You maybe become someone who escorts people to their appointments at a clinic. You know, helps them navigate the protesters who are standing outside, crowding outside of doors to Planned Parenthood and other clinics. You become that person who's a friendly face who helps someone navigate, you know, what can often be an unfriendly crowd. You have conversations with your friends and family members who are not as connected to sources of information that are trustworthy and who are swayed by some of the, you know, some of the lies that the anti-choice movement attempts to spread, and really, you know, participate in the conversations that could shed light on why it's important that women should have access to good health care. So I think that, you know, I haven't seen any kind of really shiny new solutions being offered. I'm really seeing kind of the typical ways that people support access to reproductive health care being lifted up as good things for people to do right now.
So, yeah, I think that part of this is people just don't know quite. I mean, politicians run from it a lot. Mm-hmm. Again, I think people are afraid of the word abortion. I think that people are afraid to defend Planned Parenthood in some ways. I know what Hillary Clinton said, but I mean, as people are afraid to kind of cross that line again, even though it's a line we thought we crossed 40 years ago. And I think that's part of the problem. And then you also have the rhetoric going on at the moment with a real push saying that abortions are black genocide.
Right.
And that's, you know, I'm saying that there's a complexity to this, that I think it's important to put our hands around.
Yeah, I mean, the black genocide argument, I just, like, when is it going to go away? I mean, I think it is so disrespectful in that it ignores the fact that Margaret Sanger was responding to black leaders asking for support in setting up clinics in our neighborhoods. You know, it was responding to the desire, the fact that Planned Parenthoods were set up in black neighborhoods was a response to women saying, I need to have more control over my life, right? I mean, exactly the same thing that people say today, regardless of race or ethnicity. But the difference in a lot of black communities was that it becomes an issue of economic survival or not. I mean, if you don't have money to feed another mouth, what are you going to do? So I just am so frustrated, and I'm actually quite surprised by how effective this so-called black genocide messaging has been. And, you know, these black pastors, the Stephen Broders and the Alveda Kings and these people who get trotted out by the right wing, you know, anti-choice movement to sell these arguments to black communities are just doing such a disservice. And I just find it so disrespectful because it tells a narrative in which black people have no agency, in which we can't make decisions about our own family size and a desire to have access to health services that allow us to control the size of our family. So you're right. I mean, it is incredibly complex. And I think, you know, what do you do? Hopefully, you know, just pushing back every time that these lies and these distortions of history get told, I think that that's at least a step toward, you know, moving more people along.
And it's also kind of, to me, it seems to be a part of a larger political struggle, too. I mean, you see you wrote this piece on Lark that we talked about a couple of weeks ago together. I should remember that off the top of my head, but I do not
long-acting reversible contraception is what it stands for, and it typically refers to the IUD or hormonal implants, which, as the name suggests, last quite a long time once they're inserted by a medical professional.
And now there's a push by some major anti-abortion groups to ban IUDs, to ban government funding of IUDs.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's interesting because actually in my reporting, because of the Affordable Care Act, which made it the case that there's no copay on contraceptives, it should be the case that the IUD is widely available to anybody who wants it, just like the pill or the depot shot or, you know, something along those lines. But actually what I found was that the National Women's Law Center has received complaints from every state from women who are not able to get their IUDs covered because, you know, the IUD just they're like having to battle their insurance companies to get coverage. So, you know, so just to get back up a little bit and say the idea that the IUD is widely available, it's certainly becoming more available and used much more broadly, but there are still these challenges even in terms of getting access. So that's one thing. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's fascinating. I just saw the news this morning that Ted Cruz what, you know, is making these comments about basically saying that the Democrats have created this fiction that, in fact, there is no Republican war on women, that, you know, Republicans are not against contraception. He called the war on women a completely made up threat and said that Democrats are trying to convince Americans that, quote, someone's trying to steal their birth control. And the reason why he says it's so obvious that, you know, birth control is widely available is because you can get a condom. You can go buy condoms anywhere you want. And when he was in college, you know, you could, there was even a machine that you could use to get your condoms. And so I just thought it was so fascinating because, so condoms are the only form of birth control that we should be allowed to use and have access to. I mean, one of the reasons why the IUD and LARC is being, you know, talked about so much and why there's such a push for expanded access is because the IUD and the hormonal implant, these are birth control devices that are 99% effective compared to, you know, the condom, which is something like 86% effective. So even just looking at, you know, and as you and I talked about, Mark, you know, the efficacy is not the only reason why a woman would choose a particular type of birth control. There are all kinds of other considerations. But, you know, for Ted Cruz to suggest that a type of birth control that is, you know, much less effective in preventing unintended pregnancy than other types, that we should just be fine. We should feel that, you know, that that'll do the trick. It's just absurd. I'm pretty disheartened to hear about these right-wing attacks on birth control, particularly when it comes to the IUD. And I think it proves exactly what you said. There's this much larger political struggle, where we see these, you know, the anti-choice movement, but with a lot of support from somehow mainstream Republican candidates and Republican politicians, just attempting to limit women's abilities to have control over the size of their families.
Right. And I know people, though, who, you know, take a political position who are anti-abortion, but also mm-hmm. pro-choice.
Uh-huh. In terms of their personal decisions versus, right.
Right. And I think that's – and to make the argument about the, being opposed to abortion – part of that argument, I think, is about what you wrote about the other week, which is contraception. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people are worried about – and I understand some of the worry people have that 36% of all abortions are the stat I read that they always being used, I guess it's correct, are black women in America, then we should begin making contraception available and teaching – and safe sex and teaching how to use contraceptives, which we did 30 years ago. And 30 years ago when I worked in a high school, I did that in 1977-79, and we had a group that actually taught that.
Right.
And people yelled at us.
Right.
Said, you shouldn't be doing this. No, you know.
That's absolutely right. It's not – it's about – I mean, contraception as part of a broader conversation about health, right? I mean, the Republicans try to act like, oh, you know – the left uses this word health, but they're really talking about abortion. No, it's really about, you know, the full range of sexual and reproductive health. So making contraception widely available is incredibly important. Having sex ed that is actually realistic and tied to people's lives, not just this abstinence-based or abstinence-only sex education, because that is not really in line with how, you know, it's just some teenagers are going to have sex and we have to deal with that reality. We all, you know, also having conversations with young people, not just about how to prevent getting pregnant, but how to make sure that they are not, you know, being exposed to STIs, chlamydia, gonorrhea. And when we look at health disparities, I wish I had the stats right in front of me. I don't, unfortunately, but, you know, black girls are, you know, are at much higher risk of contracting chlamydia than their white counterparts. I think it's something like 57% of new HIV infections are among black youth.
In your article, I just pulled up your article. So it's hard to keep these things in our heads.
Yeah.
That in the United States, between the ages of 15 and 24, half of all STIs acquired each year are in black communities. the chlamydia rate for young black women is 5 times that of their white counterparts,
right,
where young black men contract the disease at nearly 10 times the rate of young white men. And
so these are critical. I mean, that's heartbreaking. And, you know, in that article, I spoke to an OBGYN at the University of Chicago who said, okay, this is great. Yes, let's make the IUD more widely available for sure. But the IUD is not a barrier method. The hormonal implant is not a barrier method. So we also, even as we make these highly effective forms of birth control available, we still have to be having conversations with our young people about how to stay healthy and safe.
And the trick here, I guess, then is finding a way, as we talked about earlier, to create this analysis popularly understood about the connections between the politics of something the very kind of right wing fearful politics of where America's going to the kind of attacks on Planned Parenthood and other clinics that provide abortions and other health care for women. And making that connection to me seems to be a very critical piece to do.
I would agree. You know, this week, Senate Republicans are expected to vote on a bill that includes a measure to defund Planned Parenthood. This is all building from these deceptively edited videos that were released in July and the kind of congressional hearings that we then had to watch. You know, Cecile Richards, the CEO Parenthood, being asked the most ridiculous questions by members of our Congress. You know, so now here we are in December with a bill in front of the Senate that could, you know, potentially end Medicaid reimbursements to Planned Parenthood. And, you know, of course, I believe President Obama said that he would veto it. And I think it will be an especially hard, I hope that it would be an especially difficult measure to pass in the wake of these Colorado Springs shootings. But yes, I mean, we're seeing the real political consequences of this kind of fear mongering that the anti-choice movement has spread.
Dana McLean, I want to say it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I enjoy your work. I'm glad you appreciate that you take the time to join us here on the Mark Steiner Show with your work and contributing right for the Nation, Fellow the Nation Institute. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's always such a pleasure to speak with you.
On our way to break, I want to remind you, join me on January the 13th, the 13th Annual Annapolis Summit at the Governor Cavern House on the opening day of the state legislature in Annapolis. It's your chance to have your questions answered when we talk with Governor Larry Hogan, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. To save your seat or get information about sponsorships, go to dailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit or call Morgan Cook at 443-524-8181 or email her morgan.cook@thedailyrecord.com. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by the Daily Record, the Maryland State Education Association, Stevenson University, Alexander and Cleaver, BPC, and WEAA. Be part of the Annapolis Summit. Join us. Call 443-524-8181. When we come back, I sit down with Towson University Interim President Dr. Timothy Chandler and discuss the rebellious life of Miss Rosa Parks since December the 1st marks the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott. Stay with us.